Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me
is Mike Cosentino. Yes, he is.
And we have a guest today.
We do have a wonderful guest today. We've had her on the show before. Alice Rothschild, are you there?
Yep, I am here.
Good morning, good morning.
Sounds like she's
good
there.
Good morning.
Alice wrote a wonderful book called Condition Critical, based on her trips to Israel, Palestine, and the conditions in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I wanted to.
She's a well-known peace activist. She's a doctor, medical doctor.
Absolutely, I will read
filmmaker.
Her stellar biography here. Alice Rothschild was born in Boston in 1948. Oh, we're the same age. She grew up in Shannon, Massachusetts, moving to Brookline, Massachusetts, for her last year of high school. Alice graduated from Bryn Mawr in 1970 with a B.A. in psychology and subsequently attended Boston University School of Medicine. Class of 1974, followed by a medical internship at Lincoln Hospital in the South Bronx, and obstetrics and gynecology residency at Beth Israel in Boston. She has worked, they provided OBGYN and pediatric care to unique mix. Am I on radio? A unique mix of urban poor. And certainly she, Alice has developed an interest in progressive politics, which is why she's on Democratic Perspective, in the 1960s and 70s, starting with campus opposition to the Vietnam War. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you so much. It's good to be there.
We want to talk about the situation in Gaza and the West Bank. There's been a recent incursion in Gaza. It's kind of hard to understand in some ways, but maybe we should lay out a little more about what Gaza is. It's a tiny strip of land. It's the third most population dense area in the world.
Yeah, most Americans don't know anything about
it. It's 25 miles long. It's 3.7 to 7.5 miles wide. I guess you say there's about 2 million Palestinians living there. The birth rate is very high. Israel has an extensive buffer zone inside the Gaza Strip, which renders much of the arable land off limits. So we have a situation where I think it was 2007, something along those lines. Israel moved its occupation and its settlements out of Gaza. It controls the air above Gaza. It controls all the entrance and exits. It controls the sea. It set limits on how far Palestinian fishermen can go out and fish. So there's a debate, but basically Israel controls it. But it doesn't occupy it in the sense that it used to. So I think that Gaza must be one of the most miserable places in the world to live. There's fighting. It looked as if there was a peace deal being worked out between Hamas that controls Gaza, which is a very Islamic extremist group, at least to Americans, and Israel, and then Israel sent in an intelligence operation, and they got caught getting out, and a bunch of people were killed, and then the Palestinians retaliated with some rockets, and the Israelis retaliated with a bunch of airstrikes. And so what seemed like a promising situation, we now no longer know exactly what's happening. Go ahead.
Can I jump in? So first of all, I do think that by international law, Gaza is an occupied territory. And so to say that it's not occupied is really not fully accurate. It's occupied in a different way, but it is an occupied territory. And the so-called intelligence operation that happened, I think it was November 11th, you got to back up one step, which is that Egypt was negotiating a truce between Hamas and the Israeli government in response to the Great March of Return. And there's a longstanding pattern of whenever there is some kind of truce negotiations or an opportunity to de-escalate, that there's very, very often a military operation by Israel to throw everything off. And there's actually been studies done on this, and the Israelis break truce agreements something like 80% of the time. And so I see this as part of a pattern of obstructing any possibility of calming things down. And it's not clear. I mean, the Israelis are calling this an intelligence operation, but they did assassinate Hamas leader. And so from the Palestinian point, this was an extrajudicial killing, which is also not legal under international law. So I think it's important to put it in the context of the most recent truce negotiations. And it's true that it's unclear whether everything is completely deranged now or whether they're going to get back on track with this little blip. And also, I think you have to put it in the context of the fact that Netanyahu is facing all these indictments. Whether he'll ever be indicted is a whole other question. But also that when he was negotiating this truce, that his defense minister resigned, saying that he's just being too soft on the Gazans and he has to really punish them and teach them a lesson. So he was facing a possibility of his coalition splitting up, which it has not. So there's all, he's also playing to his base, so to speak, in Israel. So it's a much more complicated arrangement when you look at the whole picture.
And the Israelis pretended to be a part of, according to Israeli newspaper, pretended to be part of a humanitarian group and had all their passports and stuff entered as being something like, say, the United Nations or one of these nonprofits that helps people out in Gaza. And that's going to cause further ramifications because apparently the Gazans now don't trust anybody.
Sure.
I mean, we're talking to Alice Rothschild and her book, Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel and Palestine. Part of why Democratic Perspective is doing this show is that Donald Trump has kind of sucked every moment of every show of every a bit of information for the last 2 years, and there are other things happening in the world. Since your trips that you wrote about in the book, Alice, you've been back to Israel. Can you tell us about those?
So I've been going almost every year since 2005, and I was last in Gaza January of 2017. And I think that it's important to understand that Gaza is sort of an invisible humanitarian catastrophe that's just getting worse and worse and worse. As you mentioned, it's a very tiny strip of land. It's completely under siege, so it's almost impossible to get in or to get out or to have any economic trade back and forth. And because of there were three major attacks, the last one was in 2014, there are some very, very important problems, like the infrastructure was bombed, particularly water infrastructure. So there are some major issues that affect health as well as human rights. And one of them is adequate housing because so many houses were destroyed. The water issue is very, very prominent. I think the UN is estimating that 98% of the water is no longer drinkable. And that's partly because the water infrastructure was destroyed. And then the Israeli government wouldn't allow materials to come in to fix it. So there's a tremendous amount of contamination. And also, Gaza is fed, the water is fed by these aquifers that are over-pumped. And, you know, nobody in a normal world would think that a little coastal area like that could completely supply its own water. So there is water brought in from Israel that they buy, but it's totally inadequate to the needs of 2 million people. So then this raises all sorts of issues around sanitation, around adequacy of food. But it's really clear that the Israeli blockade restrictions is the bottom line that's causing this catastrophe. And from a health point of view, there has been a longstanding policy of what the academic Sarah Roy calls de-development of Gaza. So before all the blockade and wars, Israel used Gazans as a source of cheap labor, but they wouldn't approve anything major to build infrastructure and improve education and all the kinds of things that a area would need. So it's has a problem with not enough stuff. So, for instance, there was one major rehabilitation hospital. It was 30 years old. It was, you know, first world care, and that was bombed to the ground in 2014. So if you have an enormous number of people who are wounded and injured and no first world level rehab facility, then patients need to go outside the strip. But something like maybe half the patients who apply for permits actually get them for medical care. And it takes a long time, and the Israelis have keep increasing the number of days you have to apply in advance for getting a permit. So you have to know, I think now, 52 working days ahead of when you need medical care, that you need emergency medical care. So there are all these things that make it really, really difficult. And then because of all the restrictions about things getting in and getting out, there's a severe drug shortage. Something like 47% of essential drugs are at zero stock. Zero. There's an antibiotic shortage, you know, and so there are all these crises related to the infrastructure. The medical staff, many of them have not been paid or been paid only partially because there's a, you know, money catastrophe going on, and they're working, you know, 24/7 because of all the injuries from the Great March of Return, which happens every Friday, and from the recurrent incursion. So there's just one thing after another, and the Israelis do have recently, with this Great March of Return, a policy of shooting at the legs of demonstrators. So there's a vast increase in young men whose legs have been destroyed or blown off who need high-level orthopedic care, which is not available on the Strip. And so there are all sorts of things like that that make life really hard. And it's been well documented that patients are dying, you know, and that this is clearly impacting both morbidity and mortality.
Ellis Rothschild, author of Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel and Palestine, is painting us a picture of what it's like to live in that area today. There's so much that is confusing, but I do want to step back.
It's a kind of enforced dependency that isn't it? If you can't get medical care in Gaza, the water has to come from Israel, the electricity, the entire infrastructure. I see one.
And I should say they only have 4 hours of electricity a day, and it's erratic. There's a rolling blackout.
And there's poverty there. It's an extremely poor area. How could it be otherwise? And the population is increasing. It looks like an absolute humanitarian disaster now, and an even bigger one in the future if nothing changes.
Right.
We're talking about the details, but I do want to. Go ahead, Alice.
Everybody is devastated, but there's a huge percentage of the population is devastated. And the other thing is that 70% of Gazans are refugees and live in one of the 8 refugee camps. And the U.S. This year slashed funding for UNRWA, which is the U.N. organization that runs the refugee camps, does housing, does health care, does education. So not only does this mean that those services are now not going to be as available, and that there's going to be rising malnutrition and less educational opportunities, but there were thousands of people employed by UNRWA, so now all those people are unemployed. And the World Bank has said that the Gaza economy is collapsing, and the Ministry of Health has said that they're now in a state of emergency. So this is a catastrophe that's like unfolding in front of us that's all preventable. So I think it's important to keep it in that context. The people are very resilient. And, you know, for instance, I'm involved with a program called We Are Not Numbers, working with university students and people who've graduated who want to write better English. And so, you know, they're going to school, they have dreams to be a journalist, you know, all this stuff is all going on at the same time that the world is falling apart around them.
What potential, I mean, does a young person have in Gaza of realizing sort of normal young person dreams of, say, being a journalist or becoming a doctor or whatever? It seems like there's a deprivation of possibilities as well as physical deprivation of the place.
I mean, the thing that's very interesting about Palestinian culture in general is that people really value education. So there's a huge amount of youth going to college, and getting advanced degrees. And so you'll find people living in refugee camps who have masters in social work. I mean, it's a very interesting dichotomy. But there is currently the unemployment rate for college graduates in Gaza is 63%. So it's a real sort of they dream, but there's no place to take their dreams kind of situation. There's a medical school. There are multiple universities. You know, all of that's going on, but there's a real inadequate place for people to go when they graduate. And so one of the big employers is non-governmental organizations, which is why so many Gazans study English, because that's a very useful language if you're going to try to work with non-governmental organizations. So there is a real crisis in terms of the unemployment and the fact that the siege is not only a siege on the economy, but it's a siege on dreams, it's a siege on hope, it's a siege on possibility. And that's really dangerous and devastating to a society.
Does it cause, I guess, long-term physical damage to people? I would think the bombings and the warfare and the deprivation and the whole tension of being there would affect people with increased diabetes or heart trouble.
Right. So, living in a chronic war situation with a huge amount of toxicity from what gets dropped from the sky and bombing and that kind of thing, as well as food insecurity, does create malnutrition. It does create high levels of anemia in children. They're now seeing stunting in children, and this all affects brain development. So there is a direct health consequence to all of this going on. You also have a population that's been massively, repeatedly traumatized. So the level of, you know, what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which in Gaza is never post, is very, very high. And I work with the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, which is an incredible organization that provides mental health care and training in Gaza. And what they see is that whenever there's something horrendous happens and there's this huge increase in, quote, PTSD without the P, the people gradually get better, and then another horrendous thing happens, and so then there's a whole new bunch of cases, plus the people who had it before relapse. So the people are living on the edge of their ability to cope all the time. And the other thing you see in children is a huge amount of bedwetting, which is a symptom of PTSD in children, and that's pretty epidemic in Gaza. And again, you know, you see kids playing in the street and they look happy and they're, you know, acting like children, but they're wetting their beds at night. So there's a big problem with the issue of trauma as well, and chronic trauma. And that then increases stress. And so there is high levels of hypertension and diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and also higher than normal levels of cancer, probably due to the toxic environment. So it does have major long-term impacts on the population. And then if you have, you know, hundreds of people getting injured and having their legs blown off, you have a massive increase in the disability population in a society that is ill prepared to actually deal with it because of all the medical issues.
I also want to step back a minute here and talk about, at least for our audience, the whole situation. Palestinians want a country. The two-state solution has been talked about forever. Israel Jews are in the Middle East, are in Israel. Palestinians want a place to live, need a place to live. Two-state solution has been talked about forever. You talked about in your book that the difference between Jewish religion and Zionism, and that there has to be a separation of that. We talked about the various United Nations campaigns. You know, Israel is came under lots of condemnation for the conditions you've been talking about since we started the show, and yet nothing changes, nothing happens. Part of what you ascribe that to is U.S. support, unwavering U.S. support. And it seems, for want of a better term, thug supporting thug. How does and one last thing, I have a friend in Tel Aviv who says there's lots of Israelis don't support what's going on, and yet we don't hear those voices. What's the situation right. with that?
So I think that you're right that Israel has a lot of different voices and a lot of different political outlooks, but the general trend of the country is right-wing, and they do keep electing people who are right-wing. And the problem with a lot of the Israeli left is that they're horrified by Netanyahu the way we're horrified by Trump. And at the same time, they're not willing to really examine what are the consequences of Zionism. So what are the consequences of setting up a society where Jews have privilege over everybody else? And so when you say the two-state solution is the thing to do, and people have been advocating for that, I mean, I've been doing this long enough to see that the two-state solution used to be a totally radical idea, and then many Israeli Jews and Jewish Americans realized that if they want to have a Jewish state, they better have a Palestinian state. And that became the sort of mainstream idea of what the solution should be. It's been undermined repeatedly by mostly by the actions of the Israeli government. And when you say that things aren't changing, I think that's not really correct, because there's a real paradigm shift that's going on within the Palestinian community, where people are saying, you know what, the two-state solution is really dead. Let's look at the realities on the ground. Israel has continued to build settlements in the West Bank. They've annexed East Jerusalem and said they now have a united capital, and East Jerusalem was supposed to be the capital of this Palestinian state. They've taken over the Jordan Valley as a closed military zone. So what's left for Palestinians is basically kind of a Swiss cheese state, which is not viable. And so in reality, what's happened is that we do have a one-state solution right now. It's just an apartheid state. It's not a state that has a future. And so what a lot of Palestinian thinkers, and also, you know, some people in Israel, but not a whole lot, and a lot of people in the U.S. are thinking about is, so the reality on the ground is a one-state solution. How can we make that a more just and better place for people to live? And one of the things that we all have to do to make that happen is to confront the consequences of a state that privileges one people over another people. And you got to remember that Palestinians now outnumber Jewish Israelis by slightly over half, and that's a trend that's going to keep continuing. So what we're seeing is we're going to have a minority Jewish population ruling over a majority Palestinian population, as that's what the future looks like. And that makes, you know, Jewish Israelis really uncomfortable and uneasy, and, you know, the sort of liberal-minded people who understand that there's a lot of terrible things going on say, well, let's give them a state. Well, you got to give them a state that's viable, and in some ways, many people feel that we've passed the time of a viable state. And the Palestinian leadership has also been miserable. You know, the Palestinian Authority, which is Fatah-based, is very corrupted and very much part of the Israeli security apparatus. You know, Abu Mazen doesn't have any succession plans. You know, Hamas and Fatah fight constantly, and it's totally dysfunctional and totally not good for the population. So there's a real disgust on the ground with amongst many Palestinians with the official leadership, and the sort of bright new ideas are really coming, I think, from civil society that's really thinking out of the box. And I think that is where the excitement is. And also, you know, we're not going to get our Congress to cut back on the $3.8 billion we send to Israel every year. We're not going to get our Congress to stop protecting Netanyahu. That is like an uphill battle, and we're opposed by billions of dollars of lobbying money and corporate interests and military interests, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that we on the ground can do is embrace the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, and I think that that is something that is actually having impact. And its main impact is not to take down an Israeli hummus industry, which is not a really big goal, but it's to tarnish the reputation of the Israeli state as a democratic state that is actually interested in peace.
Say that again. Say their name again, please.
Say which name?
Mike wants to know what the movement's called.
Oh, the movement is called Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. And
it's very much modeled on what was done to South Africa, is it not?
Yeah, it is modeled on that, although it's different because South African apartheid is very different than Israeli apartheid. But it's a, you know, people have used this strategy for hundreds of years. I mean, the Quakers used it against slavery. The Jews used it against the Nazis. I mean, it's a political strategy that has been used by people both on the left and the right, I should say. But it is a strategy that I think is very powerful and is nonviolent and is something that people on the ground can embrace even when their governments aren't listening to what the concerns are. And you see just a corroding, it's corroding the sort of perfect image that Israel has cultivated. I mean, just last week, I don't know if you saw this, but Airbnb, which has listed apartments in the settlements, which is, the settlements are illegal according to international law, and here's Airbnb renting apartments in the settlements. Now they've decided to delist all the apartments in the West Bank, not in East Jerusalem or the Golan, but it was a major step, and it's recognizing that they shouldn't be renting apartments in occupied territories. Well, this provoked a massive pushback, but they're standing by it. And this is an impact that's related to the idea that people are looking at what can you boycott? I mean, they're not using the word boycott, but, this is an impact of the boycott movement. It was in response to a report by Human Rights Watch. But
it's extremely controversial, right? It's extremely controversial, and Israel has a, over-the-top campaign against it,
right,
accusing anybody who supports it of violence, which is like a, seems, it's the kind of a charges you make when you don't think anybody can talk back to you at the same level of energy. It's controversial,
well, it's
particularly
as,
for the...
I should just say it's been labeled as anti-Semitic, which is totally erroneous, because anti-Semitic means that you hate people because of their being Jews. And if you read what the boycott is about, they first of all condemn anti-Semitism, and the boycott movement is acting against the policies of a state, and a state is not a religion. So, you know, you mentioned that I try to make a clear-cut boundary between Judaism, the religion, Zionism, the political movement, and Israel, the state. And I think we have to keep those as three separate entities. They do overlap. But attacking the policies of a state is not, by definition, anti-Semitic. Hating Jews is anti-Semitic, and that's a very different thing. So, but that's Airbnb was accused of anti-Semitism, which is, you know, the usual thing that that people do when they want to attack the boycott. But it really doesn't hold water, I would like to say.
But the boycott of the advocacy of boycott of Israeli universities and colleges is extremely controversial, even with people who are very critical of Israel's policy toward Palestinians.
Right. The cultural boycott is both the most controversial and I think the most effective, because it also involves asking performers from the States and from Europe not to perform in Tel Aviv, and it really wakes people up when they hear about it. The reason that I am in favor of the cultural boycott is that they're not saying that you cannot have an Israeli professor speak at a U.S. college. They're saying that if the professor is funded in a program by the Israeli government, that is breaking the boycott. But if your university wants to pay the, you know, fees and get the professor there without Israeli funding, that's perfectly okay, because it's not about the Israeli professor. It's about the institutions that support the Israeli professor. And the reason the institutions are under attack is that many Israeli universities are actually built on occupied territories. Many Israeli universities have huge contracts with the military and big weapons development programs. So the boycott is trying to call attention to all of that and to look at the context in which these institutions are functioning. And I think that's really important.
To what extent, for example, if you're a Palestinian, can you go to Israeli universities? I know that some can go, but it seems like...
Well, if you're a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship, because something like 21% of Israelis who have citizenship are Palestinian, you can go to an Israeli university. If you're living in Gaza or the West Bank, it is close to zero that you would be able to go to an Israeli university, because you wouldn't be able to get the permit.
So if you boycott an Israeli university, you're boycotting the university that allows non-Jews. It allows Muslims and Christians to go to the school along with Jewish citizens.
Right. And you're boycotting the university because of its ties to the military, because of the location of the university in occupied territories. And that's what the political messaging is. Now, people who live in Israel who want to go to university, whether they're Jewish or Palestinian, can go to university. That's their prerogative. But this is something that the international community is being asked to do.
We did mention the word apartheid, and I didn't want to gloss over it, and then sure enough, you didn't. You did mention that it's different from South Africa. How is it different?
Right.
Flesh that out for us a little bit, please.
I mean, first of all, the histories, they're totally different histories. And South African apartheid, the big difference is that in South Africa, the whites wanted the blacks for their labor. They wanted them to be separate, but they wanted to use their cheap labor. Whereas in Israeli apartheid, Israelis have walled off the Palestinians, are not interested in their labor. They're interested in their land, and they really would like them all to go away. So it's a different kind of apartheid, and it's also because it's not like that people still can work. And that's a big issue, because poverty and lack of economic opportunity is a major problem for Palestinians in the occupied territories.
So what even in Israel, if you're an Arab college graduate, what are your possibilities to have success and realize your dreams in Israeli society? Would seem to be very different than if you're an Israeli Jew.
Well, it is different. First of all, you've got to understand that Israeli Jews and Israeli Palestinians grow up in totally segregated primary and secondary schools. So the first time that most Palestinians actually have interactions with a lot of Jews is if they can get into university. And so the elementary and secondary schools are, quote, separate but equal, but not as well funded, and, have all the issues that separate but equal has in the United States. And the problem with someone who graduates from a university who's Palestinian is that many, many jobs are require or you get the in to get the job through serving in the Israeli military. And except for the Druze, who are a segment of Palestinians, Palestinians don't serve in the Israeli military. So there's a huge amount of jobs that are just not available to them. And there are a huge amount of jobs where they're not welcome. But it is very, you can become a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship and go to law school and work for a human rights group and have a, interesting life. You're living in a racist society, but you can certainly succeed in that society if you work hard. But it's all stacked against you. So there is a tendency towards a second-class kind of citizenship if you're Palestinian in Israel, because it's a racist society, and so that has implications where you can live and where you would be welcome to work that are major problems.
When I was growing up in Oklahoma on a border state, they didn't allow we weren't segregated like the Deep South, but they segregated the schools up until high school. So you only met African American students and people when they reached high school. Otherwise, they lived all the early years when you're really making lots of friends and bonding. They lived in entirely different educational systems,
right.
And that was a pattern over the border states, and it was, I think, a deliberate wanting to keep people from becoming friends, really.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard about, according to people in other cities in Israel, that they're hiding Palestinians in some cases. That it's I'm making the comparison to the undocumented people we have in the U.S. and the Palestinians throughout Israel that somehow come. Get crosswise with Israeli authorities and get sent somewhere Is this a consideration that you've run into?
I've never heard of that. I just haven't heard of it. I don't know if it's true or not.
Alice, what about the future? Now, you talked a little bit about, do you think that the one-state solution is the way to go? How do we get out of a mess that's been certainly around since I was a kid? One war after another, all this killing, very little progress, oppression, domination, fighting for power. What's the way out of it that you see, the clearest process? The increase of NGO activity, what do you see?
So first of all, I don't think there's any clear way out of this because we're all in this together and we're living in a world with, you know, rising right-wing fascistic governments in Europe and, you know, this is all a piece. We have Yemen completely devastated and the U.S. supporting Saudi Arabia and there are all sorts of really crazy things going on. So it's not like I could say, well, the easy way to do this is to move forward doing X. I do think if I look at the sort of big picture, that setting up a country that's based on the privileging of Jews over everybody else is not a long-term viable plan because everybody else is going to be chronically resistant to that plan. So, you know, I would support the boycott movement. I would support any efforts we have for people to get to know the other side, any efforts we have to prevent people from demonizing other groups. But I really respect the Palestinian call not to normalize relations with Israel because I think that politically that's the strategy right now. And I see the Palestinian movement as basically a liberation movement, similar to the civil rights movement.
What do you mean by normalization?
It's going to look differently in different places. You know, it's going to look different in Israel where it's more like struggling against Jim Crow, and it's going to look different in the West Bank where it's more like struggling against apartheid, and it's going to look different in Gaza where everything is just much, much worse, and the critical thing is to stop the siege. It's all complicated by the internal disruptions between Hamas and Fatah, which are completely dysfunctional and bad for the people on the ground. And so the Palestinians have to figure that one out also, but they're also under the thumb of Israel. And so it gets very tortured. And Israel is basking in the Trumpian universe where it's there's no longer any limits to what they can do because of the protection from the United States. So we got a lot of work to do here, but, you know, it's all uphill. But I think you know, having done this for over 20 years, that the tone in the U.S. is changing. It's not changing nearly fast enough or quickly enough or powerfully enough. But, you know, when I started this work, we spent a year debating whether we could say the word Palestine in a title of our little grassroots organization. And now people, you know, don't have a heart attack if you say Palestine or apartheid or, you know, people, there's some widening of the understanding, although in general it's totally lacking. But I think we've got to work towards a situation where there is a just solution for everybody that is living there. And that's going to take, you know, major turnaround on sort of the framing and the understanding and also a respect for Palestinian rights and concerns and aspirations that are equal to Jewish-Israeli rights and concerns and aspirations.
Well, that's so, the authoritarian regime of Israel. And the authoritarian regime of the United States seem to have found quite a bond, and it's not helping either of its the masses of citizens that don't have the privileges. Just like Israel, I believe the United States has certain sets of privileges for white people and a few others, and they have fewer privileges as Israelis and Palestinians have by government design. And that's institutional racism in these authorities.
I mean, we didn't bring up the nation state bill, which was passed in July. And I think if people don't know this, this was a bill that has the weight of a constitutional amendment. There's no constitution in Israel, but it has the weight legally. And basically, that bill said that Jewish privilege is the law of the land. And so it was like taking it out front and making it a foundation that then allows infinite amounts of discrimination. And so it's right out there. So, you know, the battle is very clear.
Well, they would like to do that here. The Koch brothers and some of the right-wing organizations want to have a constitutional convention so we can codify, as Israel did, our racism and preferences to business. They want to write the racism and the business rules into the Constitution. We want to make sure. Alice Rothschild is an author and activist on behalf of Israel and Palestine.
She has a blog that we should mention, Mike.
She has a blog. Now, if you want the most recent information, read the book, but also go to the blog.
And give the book, let's have the book's name again.
Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel and Palestine. One of the things we want to mention before we run out of time, and then Alice will come back, don't go away, we want to talk about the people that help Democratic Perspective stay on the air. We want to thank Klaus von Stoltenberg. And as an individual, we want to thank Democrats of the Red Rocks as an organization. Cactus Kate. We laughed because it's a watering hole of one of the co-hosts of Democratic Perspective. But if we do get some rousing conversations in Cottonwood, Arizona, the community next to Sedona, regarding everything that comes on our show. We have a bar full of critics at Cactus Gang, but she puts her her appreciation in the form of a check, which you always got to appreciate about someone.
So we do want to thank all our donors, particularly our regular donors. We need just a few more, and we'll be pretty solvent. Ask Alice. Let's get back to Alice. We've got like 4 minutes left, and Alice, how would you sum up? You've spent a life in political activism as well as medicine. How would you sum up? Has it been satisfying to you? And what would you recommend now to younger people and older people for that all that matter?
Well, obviously, I love doing this because I keep doing it. I find that making noise is much better than being silent. And that there is a tremendous amount of satisfaction in pursuing issues around justice and equity and equality, and it's really a very powerful way to live. You know, I grew up in a very traditional Jewish household. You know, when I went to Israel when I was 14, I had never heard the word Palestinian. And so for me, learning about the history beyond what I was taught in Hebrew school was tremendously liberating, because suddenly it made sense. And then my job was to figure out where do I put myself in that history. And I think that although I'm sure there are many Jews who would disagree with me, that there is a prophetic tradition within Judaism that even for us secular Jews gives us a foundation and a direction on how to approach these really difficult, painful issues. So I really find being a social justice activist tremendously satisfying. And also, as a physician, you know, I was trained to heal the patient, but I also feel like part of our job is to heal society. And so I love to use my physician skills to do both the micro and the macro, because it makes it feel much more like you're getting something done.
We've given a lot of information there. Alice Rothschild, thank you. We got a lot of information. You can find this show and all our shows, so you can sort it all out again, at VVID. They told me to say it slower down at the bar. VVID.org. VVID.org is where the podcasts of Democratic Perspective are kept, the secret vault. Actually, not a secret vault, the public vault of Democratic. You can find all our old shows there. You can also find them archived on TuneIn. TuneIn.com also has many of our shows archived there. BVID.org. Thanks, folks. Democratic Perspective. We'll see you next week talking about young people in politics.
Yes.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.